Politics Uncensored with Ali Milani.
Hello, everybody. This is Ali Milani on another edition of Politics Uncensored. We have a big show as the political stories keep on coming after the local elections. We've got Zach Polansky, Deputy Leader of the Green Party, joining us to talk about the election results and particularly what seemed to be a good night for the Greens. Joining us after Zach will be Alon Pinkes, Israeli diplomat and former foreign policy advisor to two Israeli prime ministers, talking about the imminent invasion of Rafah and the international situation Israel seems to find itself in, with even Joe Biden suggesting holding arms. But before we get to that, we have Zoe Grunwald in the studio, political journalist, broadcaster and commentator. And excitingly enough, Zoe's going to be joining us as a returning co-host. We loved you so much, we're going to keep you in the chair. How are you feeling?
I'm very happy. Thank you so much for having me back.
You are such a superstar. We couldn't have you just on for a short segment. We wanted you all to ourselves. So I really appreciate you joining us. And we're going to start with the week unwrapped, and that's where we talk about the big political stories of the week. And first, it's Conservative MP Natalie Elphick, who has defected to the Labour Party. The Dover MP who campaigned for Brexit said change in the Tory party since she entered. She said that the Tory party had changed since she'd entered Parliament in 2019. And this has been dramatic and cannot be ignored. She hit out at the broken promises of Rishi Sunak's tired and chaotic government, adding that Labour looks to the future, to building a Britain of hope, optimism, opportunity. And Miss Elphick is the second Tory MP to move to the Labour Party in 11 days, though her defection has caused quite a stir, particularly from all wings of the Labour Party, given her right-wing politics. Zoe, what's your reaction? I think, of all the Conservative MPs, someone to the right of Rishi Sunak was not expected to defect.
Absolutely. So the other week we saw Dr. Dan Poulter defect, and he is a much more moderate Conservative. So he defected to Labour, and he is also a practising doctor. And he said the reason he defected was because he can no longer look his NHS colleagues in the eye and be a Conservative MP. He cannot forgive years of failure, and he believes in Labour's plan for the NHS. Now, that is a great defection. I think everyone can agree on that. It bolsters Labour's record on the NHS. It gives a nice jab in the ribs to Rishi Sunak.
But particularly, as also he said, he's not going to restand. It's not got no political future. That's done.
Exactly. Right? It's just a kind of it's a gesture,
it's
really.
A principal position. Yeah.
But Natalie Elphick is a whole different kettle of fish, right? So she came in 2019 after her husband had been convicted of sexual offences. She defended her husband quite vocally in public. She was quite, I would say, scornful of some of the victims. She has been criticised for having a second job, so she's chair of the new Homes Board. And she's also very right-wing on immigration and very socially conservative. She voted to criminalise abortion in Northern Ireland. She's been quite vocally against the fire and rehire legislation, which was brought in. I mean, all of these kind of values are very kind of the opposite of what the Labour Party stands for. And so the idea that Keir Starmer would welcome her in, well, yes, OK, it's a big jab to Rishi Sunak. It's a big jab to him in a week where he thinks immigration's finally going well. He got the Rwanda bill through. She's actually saying, no, I don't trust you on our border security. But when you think about what it looks like for Keir Starmer to accept someone like this into the party, I think a lot of people are very disappointed. You know, they say Labour should be a broad church, but this broad? Someone so anti-immigration, someone with very kind of conservative values. And Keir Starmer, former director for public prosecutions, has made quite a lot of noise about wanting to halve incidents of violence against women and girls. Bringing someone into the party who's been quite vocally critical of victims of sexual violence, I think has really upset quite a lot of Labour MPs. Quite a lot of female MPs I was talking to yesterday are very upset by this decision. So it's you can understand the logic, but I think when you look at her principles, it's quite hard to digest.
Yeah, and what's interesting is there's always conversations in the Labour Party around the factionalism of it. But my observation, just in the 24 hours afterwards, the text, the message I got from MPs, people were ballistic on all sides, largely not because they said, look, it does damage to Rishi Sunak, but what does it say about us? Oh, that either we're so confused, we don't know what we believe in, that we've got, and I think it was really interesting, I saw a tweet that said, you know, a Labour Party is such a broad church, it has Zara Sultana and Natalie Elphick in the same party, who I don't think would agree on a single thing. And, you know, given that Labour's position and difficulty he's had with ethnic minority communities, for example, her position saying that the refugee crisis just doesn't exist and it's all legal migration. Does this actually do a little bit of damage to Keir Starmer, who already gets accused of not knowing what he believes in, now bringing someone her in?
I think definitely. I mean, I just think this is a party that's 20 point ahead in the polls, at least. He doesn't need to be getting little wins and firing little jabs at Rishi Sunak. The Rwanda plan isn't going to work. Immigration was going to come back to bite Sunak again. We all knew this. I don't think he needed this. And I think actually Starmer, who makes such a... We talk about what does he stand for. Actually, I think the one selling point he has is that he is a former public servant. He is a well-established human rights lawyer. He is whiter than white. He's clean, you know? Mm-hmm. To bring someone in who has been embroiled in scandal and sleaze, yeah, and to welcome her in and her values be so antithetical to what the party represents, I think like it's going to confuse the message a lot.
They're 20 points, or we're 20 points ahead. Why would he even do that? It doesn't need her defection. It doesn't do anything for him. Doesn't bump the polls. Why are they so utterly obsessed with this sort of political activity?
I think it's accumulation effect, right, isn't it? So you had Dr. Dan Poulter defect 2 weeks ago. Now you have Natalie Elphick. You have the series of disastrous local election results. People who aren't that engaged in politics will just see these headlines, and it's almost, it just hammers away. The Tories are failing. The Tories are failing. So on that basis, yes. But the problem, I think, is going to come inside his own party. If he gets into Downing Street with a sweeping majority, there's still going to be MPs who are annoyed about some of the decisions he's made. And eventually, you know, the reality of governing... I
mean, and that was what Boris Johnson discovered very harshly, right? He was a great campaigner and he won a big majority. But eventually, you have to govern. And all of these problems could unravel in government for Keir. I wonder if you can talk a little bit about, you know, our outside perceptions of Keir. I mean, I've... As folks know, met him, spoken to him, worked with him in the past, but don't know him particularly well at all. This thing does keep coming up that people don't really know what he stands for, that he is a little bit of a flip-flopper. And I think this does everything to reinforce that. Right.
Yeah, I think I think unfortunately it does reinforce that image, and I don't necessarily think that image is always totally fair. I think the thing about Keir is he has a lot of quite influential advisors around him. He's learning a lot from previous Blairite and Brownite grandees, so people like Peter Mandelson, Gordon Brown, David Blunkett. They're all still advising the Labour government, and I think he's a pragmatist. He's quite practical. He likes to look at solutions, and he wants everything to be costed. He doesn't want to offer these wide sweeping radical gestures. Now, that's something you can criticise him for, because arguably the country is crying out for some radical change. You can see public institutions failing. But I think decisions like this, they just cause more internal trouble than they're worth for what could be a very, very tiny... I don't even think it would amount to a substantial poll lead. It might hammer away that the Tories are failing, but people already know the Tories are failing. Given another week, they'll fail again.
It seems like the strategy and the advice he's getting is to make the jump from 2019 Tory voters to 2024 Labour voters as small of a jump as possible. And giving these, seeing these Conservatives defect to Labour might reassure some voters who may want to lend Labour their votes one time or whatever in a general election. The problem is, eventually... you lose who you are, right? And what you can offer. And there's two problems with that. One, your own internal mess. And like I said, I haven't seen anger from all wings, and particularly the sort of centre-right of the party, the way I've seen with Elphick. People were going ballistic overnight. That may have calmed down. Particularly from what I hear, these are rumours and allegations, but the women's PLP was particularly angry, you said, because of her support and some of the allegations of things that she said during her husband's trial, things like, I believe he is being punished for being an attractive man. And we're talking about a sexual assault case which saw him get prison time, I believe. So quite understandably and reasonably, women MPs and women across the party are fuming. So there's that internal pressure that he creates for himself. But there's also the issue of a mandate in government. He's going to have to do some quite radical things. The economy is in serious state. The NHS is in serious state. They need... whatever way you view it, quite radical action. And he may not have that mandate to do that come the general election. So is this something, and we'll move on from the story, but is this something that could unravel for him? Great election campaigning strategy, but could it unravel in government?
You can, I mean, we don't know what sort of majority Keir's going to end up in Downing Street with. And actually, part even if he does get a sweeping majority and he thinks, I'm pretty safe, I don't even need to keep the left of my party on side that much, that can be kind of naive, because when you are part of a big party with a big majority, you can actually get a bit braver about your asks, mm-hmm. you know, because you know that if you do, if you rebel or if you start misbehaving or briefing against your party, nobody's going to really come looking for you because it doesn't matter too much. So in a weird way, actually a big majority isn't something to feel particularly comfortable about. But you're right. And there are a few things now we're seeing that are becoming sticking points for Labour. We've got their position on Gaza. We've got their attitude to public spending. We've got their Green U-turn. And now we've got this. And these things, they accumulate and mm-hmm. they chip away and they annoy and piss certain people in the party yeah. off. And that's exactly what Starmer's going to have to deal
so
with.
So let me ask you about this. I'm going to go off script. I hope you don't mind. Because a lot of the things that you said, the Green U-turn... Mm. We've had the, and we're not going to talk about it today because it's literally just broken, but there's been a lot of U-turns mm-hmm. on the New Deal for Workers. We've had Keir's personal U-turns on his pledges. We've had the U-turn on utilities, particularly water, being renationalised. He has U-turned on quite a lot. Could that come back to bite him? You know, is there a point in which people go, well, how can I trust anything you say? And what's to say what you promise in this general election will actually happen in government?
Absolutely. And I think the big test is going to be when Keir Starmer, assuming he does, sits down in number 10, how bad are the books? How much change can he actually affect in 5 years? If actually in 5 years' time, come the next general election, people don't feel anything's changed. There's still an NHS waiting list. They still can't get doctor's appointments. They still don't have any money in their pocket at the end of the day. People, I think, definitely will say mm-hmm. broken promises. And he's already set himself up for that narrative. Yeah. You can already feel the cogs turning in CCHQ. So,
can I posit something? And I think it's unlikely but possible. Mm. Everyone's been saying, and I think we previous show that we said, you know, we both agreed that I think there's going to be a Labour majority, perhaps a big one. The local elections, they're very different. I know people vote differently. That caveat, obviously central in there. But the local elections showed that Labour's national poll lead is probably closer to 9% as opposed to 20% that we're seeing. And so they might walk into a general election campaign with a 9% majority. If there is the right sort of coalescing of variables, like a little bit of complacency amongst the Labour vote. Everyone thinks Labour's going to get massive majority, so some people might stay at home and not vote. Gaza being a huge anger in Muslim seats particularly. And if the general election campaign doesn't go well for Labour, a la Theresa May, we may end up with a hung parliament, an unexpected one. Do you see that as at all a possibility?
It's an interesting question. I personally don't. I think there is a lot of angry, disappointed voters who didn't come out and vote at local election time, but will come out and vote at general election time. We also, I'm not sure if we've got the stats back yet about the impact that voter ID has made to local election turnout, but you're hoping that as future elections come on, as the message gets out and people do turn up, even Boris Johnson with their with their voter ID.
The most Boris Johnson thing of all time, by the way, the man who was behind voter ID didn't take his own ID to
but
the poll.
But don't you think it's such a setup?
Do you think?
I think he did it on purpose, 100%.
He is the type.
Yeah.
He is the type. I once did a BBC interview with him, a sort of back and forth in Uxbridge, and it was a stand camera. It was out in the field, if you will. And this is one of my first political interviews. And I see Boris. He stood one side of the camera. I'm stood to the other side of the camera. And just before we go on air, he takes a step to the right, tilts his head down, messes up his hair, almost gets into character, head back up, back on camera, and it's Boris Johnson switched on. Mm. And I always said to everyone, if you can believe it, the man that I saw in private often is a ruthlessly right-wing, self-interested politician, not particularly goofy, kind of an idiot, but not particularly goofy. And the character he plays on TV is just that. It's a character. Mm. And it's perfectly possible that Boris Johnson himself did that on purpose. We're going to move on to the next story, and that's new Scottish First Minister John Sweeney has unveiled his cabinet with Kate Forbes taking the role of deputy. Mr. Sweeney was legally sworn in as Scotland's seventh First Minister at the Court of Sessions in Edinburgh on Wednesday. Sweeney pledged that Ms. Forbes, who chose not to run in the SNP leadership race, would play a significant part in his government. Ms. Forbes, who served as finance secretary under Nicola Sturgeon, has replaced Shona Robinson as second in command. Zoe, I want to ask you about this. I don't know a whole lot about about Scottish politics, but I always had the perception that the SNP were this sort of nationalist party with a liberal twinge, a sort of left-leaning nationalist party. Kate Forbes is quite far away from that, particularly on social issues. We heard her positions in the last leadership race particularly cause a stir around equal marriage. That combined with the difficulties that the SNP have with Nicola Sturgeon and the investigations going there, are they in quite a bit of trouble?
Yeah, it's interesting. And I think a good comparative point for this is actually the Conservatives, because what you have here is a party that were united by one issue, yeah, and that was independence. So you might have been what we would call a Tory, but you were in favour of independence and therefore you would join the SNP. You might have been left-leaning, Labour, yeah, liberal, Labour supporter, but you know, again, independence. So you join the SNP. It's the same as the 2019 Conservative caucus, right? They were all joined by, let's get Brexit done. Yep. Let's just get this done. And now we are seeing an incredibly divided Conservative Party where they can't even agree on the levels of tax, basic Conservative, yep, things like the levels of taxation, social issues, things like that. And I think what it shows is when you have such dominant political issues that force elections in this country, you end up with very, very split parties. So now we've got the SNP, which is led by John Swinney, who's pretty, say, pretty middle of the road, bit of an old guard, more on the sort of left of the party, but probably not as left as, you know, Nicola Sturgeon was seen. And he's made Kate Forbes his deputy, who we know is far more sort of socially conservative, economically conservative too. This is an attempt clearly to reunite the SNP, who are very divided. Mm-hmm. Will it work? Well, probably not, because all those issues are still ongoing. So one of the big things was the Gender Recognition Reform Act in Scotland that divided the SNP. Still there, still ongoing.
Yep.
Same with green issues. Scotland is very dependent on oil and gas, but we have this push for the green transition. So this could become a huge issue. Mm-hmm. So
I think that's fascinating, actually. I think your analysis is spot on. In that when you have a central one issue, whether it's Brexit or independence, first of all, campaigning is easier because message discipline is just naturally easier when you're only talking about one thing, or that's the primary thing that you're talking about. And it's coalesced people who shouldn't be in the same party. And we often have that debate in the Labour Party as well. There are people like Natalie Elphick and, like I said, Zara Sultana should not be in the same party. And the same is true of the Conservative Party and now the Scottish as well. Do you think that I don't know if it is, but as independence kind of drops down in the ladder of top priorities, that they'll have serious problems because there are people that just should not, you know, people like Kate Forbes and Hamza Yousaf, for example, naturally you wouldn't expect them to be in the same party.
No, and I think it is going to become a problem. I mean, it says, you know, I've read that in his ministerial team, Swinney's dropped the post of Minister for Independence. So it shows you how it's come down their list of priorities. I mean, the momentum for independence. And you have to take it in the context of a failed referendum, a potential Labour government coming in, and you have to see how the motivation for independence, especially with all the inner turmoil and chaos of the SNP party, has absolutely just regressed. And actually, there are lots of people in Scotland now who are thinking of voting Labour instead of the SNP.
Yeah.
If you don't have that big push for independence anymore, you have to ask what the SNP is going to be offering. And I don't know if they have a clear, coherent message because they're so divided. So John Swinney might be able to keep it together for now. I suspect it will be very difficult, but I think come general election, Scots will vote with their feet.
Yeah.
And I think you're going to see mass losses to the SNP.
Yeah, I think the suggestion is they could lose, the Conservative estimate is 20 seats at the minimum that they're looking at losing. We're going to move on to the final story as we have our first guest joining us, and that's the Green Party's former co-leader, Sean Berry, has resigned from her role on the London Assembly 3 days after being re-elected. Ms. Berry was voted into City Hall as one of the three Green Party candidates, but is now running to replace Caroline Lucas as MP for Brighton Pavilion. Excuse me. Her departure means mayoral candidate Zoe Garbutt will take her seat without the need for a by-election. Now, there's been a lot of what I think is pretty faux outrage, manufactured outrage as to Sean Berry resigning 3 days after the locals. Why, there should be a by-election. Zoe, can you explain to people exactly how this works?
So essentially, when you vote for London Assembly members, you're voting for a party. So people weren't seeing Sean Berry's name on the list and saying, yes, I desperately want her. You might have known that she was going for it, but most people were voting for the party. So But now she's resigned just 3 days later because she wants to go and stand.
Still pretty strange though, 3 days into the...
Yes, and you think you probably would have maybe thought about that before you went through the process. But I guess the problem for the Greens is that they actually have really minimal room for political success, mm-hmm. right? There's two or three seats really that they can target that they are in some likelihood of keeping. And Brighton Pavilion is probably the main one because Caroline Lucas has been the MP for there for years. To say though, they might not because there's been lots of issues with the local council there and support is waning. But we can talk about that.
Do you know what I always thought remarkable about the Greens? And someone said this to me and I had to... you know one of those things you have to fact check because it sounds like utter bullshit, but it's true. The Greens, on average, I think, they get one MP for every like 300,000 to 400,000 votes that they get. And the Tories get one for every 30,000. That's unbelievable.
And that's why they push very, very hard for PR, right? So, I mean, and actually, I think really what they want to do is they're not, they obviously would like political capital in the forms of seats, but actually they do really want to push that message of PR, proportional vote, and sort of influencing political discourse from the outside. Yeah.
Well, we're going to have a chance to talk about the deputy leader of the Green, to the deputy leader of the Green Party, Zach Pallansi. He's going to join us after this message.
Hey!
FUBAR Radio presents
Access All Areas.
Mark from Married at First Sight UK.
See, at the wedding, you told Sean you were 26, but you're actually 36.
Oh, yeah.
So drop in that decade. We ain't gone 1 or 2 years either side. What was going through your head when you thought, I'm going to shave off 10 years.
A 26. Third of your life.
Yeah.
It was instant reaction. As soon as anyone says to me, how old are you? I'm like 26. I just stopped counting after 26. Would I have told him? Probably not.
No. Ever?
Well, maybe when we're 80 years old and we've got the grandkids running around. And
except
like,
you wouldn't be 80 years old. You'd be 98.
I'd be 26 still. I'd be going around the corner for some more injections.
Politics Uncensored. Joining me now, the former leader of the Labour Party, Jeremy Corbyn, MP. And there you are stood with hundreds of thousands of people at Glastonbury singing, "Oh, Jeremy Corbyn." What is that like?
It was quite extraordinary. It was an amazing experience, and I was very pleased we did it. We wrote, the office got very excited about Glastonbury. Every single person in the office thought it was necessary for them to be at Glastonbury with me.
Yeah, I'm sure they did. Yeah.
Every single one said it was really necessary for me to come.
The Dating Show.
I'm friends with a fair few exes, and I think you can be friends with an ex, but I genuinely do. But I do think that it's timing is everything with that.
Well, I think it depends what you cast as a friend.
Yeah,
are you talking about someone you're going to hang out with on your sofa? Like, if you've already shagged, isn't that a bit weird? Or is
I think that's a different level of friend. I think that's a different level of friend. You can be friends with someone, but you can't be like best fucking friends with someone. I mean, I've got exes that I talk to about their current partners and whatever else, and they'll tell me about that sort of stuff. But I wouldn't say, oh, do you want to come over for fucking Chinese and chill on the sofa?
You're listening to FUBAR Radio.
FUBAR Radio.
Welcome back. This is Ali Milani of FUBAR Radio, Politics Uncensored. We've got a great show for you today. We've just been talking about the Green Party's results. And joining us now in the studio is Zach Pallansi, Deputy Leader of the Green Party, joining myself and Zoe Grunwald, our new co-host, who's joining us for today. Zach, I think a pretty good night for you guys at local election results.
Yeah, I'm still grinning from ear to ear. So the last four elections, we have quadrupled our number of seats across the country. And this election, again, saw historic gains. And what I really love is the historic gains are in places that might not be expected necessarily. So in Hastings, we went from the fourth largest party to the number one largest party. That was just in one election cycle. In Bristol, where we're going to be looking to get our next MP in Bristol Central, we now, or the Green Party now have every single seat in Bristol Central has gone green. Now, there's a fair challenge that people sometimes vote different nationally to the way they do locally. But you can see already that if everyone votes the same way that they just did last week at the national election, Carla Denyer will be the next MP for Bristol Central. And all I would say to people is, if you believe that we don't have a cost of living crisis, but actually we have an inequality crisis where the richest people are doing better than ever before, whilst those who are poor are struggling to heat their homes and put food on the table, if you believe there should be a ceasefire in Gaza and you want to stand by a party who has been consistent in that and principled in that, if you think we should have a wealth tax so we're taking the money from away from the wealthiest assets, multimillionaires and billionaires, and putting that back into your public services, at this point, who else are you going to vote for? The Green Party are the very obvious option. We're not being complacent. I'll be out there all the time fighting for every single vote. But I think the route to Green Party success is becoming clearer by the day.
Yeah, but you could find yourself in a position where you turn into a protest vote. That's the worry, is it not? That people who are pretty pissed off with Labour will come to you. People who might be annoyed at Conservatives on their general green policy, like environmental Tories, if you will, could come to you. How do you transition that from being a party of protest, for example, to a party that could actually make a substantive difference to the policy agenda in Westminster?
Well, when people vote in protest because they're sick of the two old parties and they want to say, we want some difference, we want environmental, social, racial and economic justice, that's not really a vote of protest. That's a vote of saying, I'm putting confidence in this party. Now, if we had a few councillors, then I would argue that's a protest vote. But when you have a serious number of councillors, every single election, your number of councillors is massively growing. We've had hundreds of people join the party in the last few days. We're the only national party whose membership is growing. I think the idea of it being a protest vote is a storyline and a narrative that's fading away very quickly. Are we a party that's growing quickly? Are there going to be challenges about how quickly we're growing? Absolutely, but we're ready to take on those challenges. And I think our new membership are too.
But you're not just a protest vote, are you? Because people also vote at local elections locally more than they would do at a general election. So at a general election, people think about who they might want prime minister. But at locals, people think about their councils, their streets, their bins, their waterways. You say if people vote like they did at local elections in a general election, you would see gains for the Greens. But people don't do that. So if you can't get those kind of votes across at a general election, how else will you influence the Westminster agenda?
So I think the very obvious thing to say is we are going to have a Labour government. That's quite clear at this point. Are people comfortable with a Keir Starmer authoritarian government where he has this huge majority, where it's very clear already, even in opposition, he is not governing from the centre or even the left. He is moving to the right. I could say this anyway, but he's just accepted a Tory MP with open arms. It's very clear what Keir Starmer's agenda is.
I was just going to push back on that, and you said the Natalie Elphick thing, and I'm done, so you carry on.
Well, there we go. And so the question is, do you want a Labour government, or do you want a Labour government with Green MPs pushing Keir Starmer towards a more progressive agenda? And this isn't some kind of fantasy, by the way. I just got elected again in the London Assembly for a second term. Sadiq Khan regularly, to his credit, says out loud that I and my fellow Greens have pushed his position on things, that we have changed his mind on things, that due to Green Party pressure, the Labour mayor is a better mayor, a greener mayor. Now, do I have objections to some of the things he does? Absolutely, clearly, otherwise he'd be in our party. But I think the idea that Green Party politicians can push Labour in power to better positions that more represent what people in this country want, to more justice positions that are, yes, both green, but also for social justice, is something that's been well proved.
So what's the best case scenario for the Green Party at a general election?
So we're targeting at least four MPs. So that's in Bristol Central, Brighton, where we already hold, North Herefordshire and Waveney Valley. But also I want to see even more MPs than that. We've realised under the cruel first past the post system that if we try and target everywhere, we end up with very, very few MPs. So we've realised we have to be ruthless about the areas we target. That all being said, though, people might say, well, what's the point of voting Green if I'm not in one of those four seats? Every single Green vote that is counted across the country sends a very clear message to Keir Starmer at the next election that our policies of taxation on the rich, of our climate emergency, our policies on that, of tackling the inequality crisis, of proportional representation, all of those things, every Green vote adds up to that.
Can I ask you about, I hate this kind of politics, but I have to ask you because it's the reality of the situation. You said you're targeting four MPs. I would posit that if you win four seats at the next general election, you'll be dancing up and down in the studio if you were here, right? Four MPs isn't going to influence Sir Keir Starmer. It's just not, given what we expect to happen in Westminster. People who are might be angry at Sir Keir Starmer, but are furious with this Conservative government and just want to see done with them, are going to be looking and going, if I vote Green and I'm not in one of these four seats, my vote's wasted. I might as well give it to Labour, make sure that we get a change of government, and we can deal with that as it comes. It's a cruel, undemocratic system. I get that. But it's the reality. If people want to get rid of the Tories, unless you're in those four seats, you're wasting your vote.
I think this is a ludicrous argument. If people want to get rid of the Tories, don't have a party that accepts Tory MPs. They're literally accepting that right now.
Zach, stop bringing that up. I don't have a response.
I also think I would defy anyone to look at what Caroline Lucas does in Parliament and say she hasn't changed the national conversation. Every time she stands up and she's principled, she speaks with authenticity, with care. She makes valid arguments based on evidence. That's how you change your politics. I would say you change your politics just having one person doing that rather than having 50 or 100 MPs who are doing nothing, who are just obeying the party whip, and who won't even stand up on the basic humanitarian crisis of our time to call for a ceasefire in Gaza. But, I don't want to keep coming back to Gaza, but I think it's an incredibly important litmus test about what these Labour MPs are ready to stand for and what they won't stand up for. And I think that's been laid transparent and bare. And if people want principled politics, they need to vote for the
Green Party. We're going to get to Gaza. I just want to, at this point, say, look, I hate that I had to ask that question because it's so ludicrous that people might support your agenda, might support everything that you're saying, but feel like they can't vote for you because then their votes will... It's
I would say the local
system.
Elections have changed this. Though. Local, we've proven yes, even under first past the post we can and do win. So it's about taking that principle from local to national, which I think
assume,
we will do.
I think Zoe said it in as we introduced you in as well, that PR would be a huge thing. Actually upending, for the Greens, upending this, what I believe now to be an undemocratic system.
Absolutely, but we have the system we have, so we've got to win under that system and we're proving we can, so let's keep doing that.
Okay, I'm gonna, with Zoe's permission, I'm just going to ask you about Gaza because it's been a huge issue. I've seen it all over your social media and the responses to the Green Party. I was shocked at how many Muslim votes went to the Green Party, and Gaza isn't just a Muslim issue. I understand that, but it is a principal issue that Muslims care about predominantly. We saw Muslim votes as much as 18% swing towards the Green Party. Your position in Gaza has been one that's probably closer to the hearts of Muslim voters and is now seeing an electoral result in that. What do you think the next steps are for the Green Party on the issue of Gaza, ceasefire, arms embargo, etc.?
Yeah, I think the first thing to say is, and I hear this caveat in your question, that it's not just a Muslim issue. I think anyone who cares about humanitarianism, compassion, and wants to stop violence is speaking out against Gaza. And from the mainstream media, I'm not including you guys in that, although I'm a fan of the show, it's sometimes presented as a contentious or controversial position, but actually we'd be taking this position anyway. But the polling is really clear too.
Yes, it is.
And when you're out in the streets, it's really clear too. People do not want to see this violence continue. And we always need to be careful when we talk about Gaza. There's obviously nuance to that. So we need a ceasefire, we need a release of all hostages, and we need a ban of arms trades to Israel. I've been saying for the past few months that, you know, the government and the Labour Party have been complicit in what has been described as a plausible genocide. I'd go stronger as that. They're not just complicit. At this point, they're enabling it. We have seen what is happening in Gaza. We are giving and selling those weapons. And actually, until we come to the point where we're ready to take a principled position and say that has to stop, I think we do need to be really clear about what this country is enabling and its government. And of course, the Labour Party aren't the opposition, but we've seen time and time again that if the opposition do not oppose, and of course the government will get away with it. That's not just imaginary. We can go back to 2008, where the government, along with the Labour opposition, did call for a ceasefire. The United Nations, America then abstained, Israel then declared a ceasefire. Mm-hmm. So there's evidence for how this can make difference. In terms of where does this need to go in the future, I'd say wider than Gaza. I've really been enjoying building relationships with the Muslim community. When we launched a new Muslim Greens group where I went in Manchester just a few months ago, they talked about how this wasn't just a Gaza relationship, but actually all through the faith as well. There's lots of links to environmental and social justice. I'm one of five Jewish people who have been in leadership positions in British politics, and I know in my own religion there's this idea of called Tikkun Olam, which means healing the world or mending the world, which for me is another way of talking about environmental and social justice. Mm-hmm. So whether you're a person of faith or not of faith, I think bringing these communities together, whereas the far right want to divide us and create tensions, I think there's a real importance here to bring people together. And with that, the final caveat I just want to say is the reaction we've seen from the Labour Party to this, where I've received, or the leadership have received, letters from the Jewish Labour movement. First of all, the way that the Labour Party have dealt with Islamophobia in their party is horrendous. The way that they hijacked the racism towards Diane Abbott, but didn't actually call out their own MPs, they just used it for political gain, has been horrendous. So we need to take anti-Semitism and Islamophobia really, really seriously. But I would just gently, and not that gently, say to the Labour Party that they ultimately need to make sure they've cleared their own party of racism before pointing fingers at other parties. And to see Peter Mandelson all over the media trying to trash the Green Party, I think was so blatantly political and transparent that actually it has backfired on the Labour Party. And I would suggest that they find a cleaner way to do politics that's actually about policy rather than trying to smear parties, because we won't stand for it.
Mm-hmm. And I just want to ask you on this issue of Islamophobia and racism. There was what I consider a hugely Islamophobic front page about Muhsin Ali, one of your newly elected councillors, who shouted Allahu Akbar, which means God is great. And he's come under investigation by the Green Party. Can I just confirm what he's being investigated for?
Yes, so we have a huge problem with Islamophobia in this country, and shouting Allahu Akbar is completely acceptable, and the idea that that would ever be a problem.
So that's not what he's being investigated for?
That is not what he's being investigated
that's
for.
That's what I wanted to make sure of. Thank you so much. That was Zach Polansky, Deputy Leader of the Green Party, who's joined us in the studio following what I think was a pretty good election results for you with me and Zoe. We're going to shift gears next. As we've been talking about Gaza, we're going to be joined by Alon Pinkas, Israeli diplomat and former foreign policy advisor to two Israeli prime ministers. He's going to talk to us about the impending imminent invasion of Rafah and what is now 7 months into a war on Gaza that's seen a human catastrophe of over 35,000 people, over half of whom are children, having lost their lives. He'll be joining both me and Zoe after this.
FUBAR Radio presents.
Thank you, guys. Sorry, I'm a bit hyper.
Joining me now is Millie Gooch, author and founder of Sober Girl Sobriety Society. I need to know what is so bad about dating sober.
I think it's just terrifying when it's something that you're not used to, because when I was drinking and dating, you know, like, you use it to calm your nerves, you use it for confidence, you rely on it. And I think that's the one thing I realised when I stopped drinking, is how much I really relied on alcohol. I was always kind of saying, you know, like, oh, I'm not dependent on it, but for my confidence I was really. But I also think there's so many benefits to it. Like, I used to go on so many dates when I was drinking, I'd be like, they are the one, and then I'd meet them like a few weeks later sober, and I'd be like, we've got nothing in common. What was going through my mind? I'd be like, oh, it was because I was drunk.
Access all areas with Bobby Norris.
Harpreet, how are you, my love?
I'm great, thank you. How are you? It looks fun in there.
I want to talk about this because obviously you met your partner on The Apprentice. When did you start to get that feeling, I'm into him and this is more than just a banter or a friendship? Because it's a close environment being on a show like that, isn't it?
I really wish I could sit here and give loads of juicy gossip. Actually, we used to secretly meet in the laundry room on the show, but we didn't. And when I actually last spoke with yourselves, I think it was right after I'd won, we weren't even flirting, never mind dating. First time that I thought I actually fancied him was when I watched him on TV and I watched episode one.
How funny.
Hang on. You know, he's actually really good looking.
Politics Uncensored with Ali Milani.
And joining me in the studio, we have Deputy Leader of the Green Party, Zach Polanski. Zach, thank you so much for joining us. How are you keeping, Zach?
I'm great. Thanks for having me. How are you?
So you're hoping for four MPs in the general. You think that's going to happen?
Yeah, that's absolutely the minimum at what we're
I don't want to be Piers Morgan here, but will you take out, I don't have £1,000, will you take a £100 bet with me that you'll get four MPs?
Well, I do everything in politics to talk about the harms of gambling. So for me to place a bet on there would be pretty, you know, pretty horrendous.
Before we had you on, we discussed with the producers as to whether I should do the bet joke, and I said I would, because I had every faith that you would answer it in the way I expect a politician of any moral standing.
We should also talk about
standing.
Cryptocurrency, which also is very problematic.
Rishi, if you're listening, mate, that's how you answer a betting question.
You're listening to FUBAR Radio.
FUBAR Radio.
FUBAR Radio.
FUBAR Radio.
FUBAR Radio.
Welcome back. This is Ali Milani at FUBAR Radio. I am joined in the studio with my co-host, Zoe Grunewald, a political journalist, broadcaster and commentator. And we've just been speaking with the deputy leader of the Green Party, Zach Polanski. And joining us now is Alon Pinkas, Israeli diplomat and foreign policy advisor to two Israeli prime ministers. Mr. Pinkas, thank you so much for joining us. We're talking about Gaza and the influence it's having around the world. We've seen Gaza be a serious issue in our elections, our local elections here. Given that the Rafah invasion seems to be imminent, and Israel's reputation around the world is in serious question, what do you think the repercussions will be for Israel if Mr. Netanyahu's government continues and invades Rafah on the ground?
Well, hi, Ali. Hi, Zoe. Good to be with you. Here's the thing, Ali. The premise of what you just said is that there's going to be a large-scale operation in Rafah, and I'm not sure about that. Given the pressures from the Biden administration in the last few days, and particularly his statement from a day ago, according to which he will halt the supply of offensive weapons if Israel proceeds with an attack in Rafah, I think there's going to be a little recalculation, a re-examination of the entire idea. That said, if Israel does, in fact, invade Rafah, which is a city in the south east part of the Gaza Strip, amid American pressures not to do so, French pressures not to do so, and international condemnations, I think it'll just, deepen the hole, the PR hole, the image, the reputation hole that Israel unfortunately still finds itself in for the last, for the better part of the last 7 months.
Yeah, and I wanted to ask you, particularly as you are a diplomat and foreign policy, former foreign policy advisor, Even Rafah aside, Israel, I think it's fair to say, has particularly put itself in a difficult position internationally with the amount of civilian losses that have been taking place in Gaza, the accusations of war crimes, of genocide. And now I think the rumors are that the International Court of Justice or the International Criminal Court might be issuing arrest warrants for senior Israeli politicians. This is the lowest Israel's international PR has ever been.
Yeah, that's true. And what is astounding, Ali, is that it should not have been this way. It should not have gotten to this point, because Israel was subject to a horrific, savage, barbaric terror attack on October 7th and justifiably responded with force, even massive retaliation force. And then the way the force was employed, the way the war was prosecuted, the way it was managed, or rather mismanaged, within a short 2-3 weeks, Israel found itself exactly where you just accurately described it, to be in its lowest position in terms of world sympathy. It started off with tremendous expressions of sympathy in Britain and France, in the U.S. and Canada, in many other places, both in the global south and the global north, so to speak. But within a very short period of time, Israel's prosecution of the war, the manner in which it attacked Gaza, and most importantly, and that's perhaps is the most important thing, the conspicuous, absolute, utter absence of any political objective, of any coherent political goal, of any framework on how post-war Gaza would be governed and managed, the absence of that exposed Israel to this criticism that you're talking about.
Alan, can I ask, obviously on Monday, Hamas had accepted or provisionally accepted a ceasefire deal, but it then got withdrawn again because Netanyahu said the proposal fell short of their demands. Can you talk to us a bit about why these deals break down and what in particular happened here?
That's a great question, Zoe, for which or to which I don't have a definitive answer. I'm sorry, but let me at least try. It seems, and I know this is a horrible counterintuitive thing to say, that both sides are not really interested in a deal. Now, why are both sides not interested in a deal? Because it goes to the very, to the essence of their respective definition of the end of the war. And that goes to the definition of what constitutes a victory. For Israel, a victory means, according to Israeli official position, toppling Hamas, eradicating, annihilating, obliterating Hamas. If the war stops now as a result of such a hostage deal, then Israel cannot claim that it won the war. Hamas, on the other hand, all it needs to declare victory is to stand on their feet and wave one flag. That's enough. And given that Israel, I'm going back to the absence of a political, a coherent and attainable political goal, given that Israel has no plan whatsoever for the day after, Hamas stays sort of in power. So Hamas has a vested interest in ending this war. But then Israel says that no matter whether there's a deal or not, it plans to proceed and attack Rafah. So Hamas is saying, well, we're not going to give up our only bargaining chip, which is the end of the war, not just the release of the hostages. So both sides find themselves in this weird, awkward, very tragic, I have to say, position in which they seem not to care whether there's a deal or not.
Mm-hmm. If I may,
I know it's a horrible thing to say what I'm saying, but that's the only analysis I can come up with.
Can I just say, look, we have a bit of experience here at home, given the Iraq and Afghanistan war as well, and we learnt very quickly that you cannot defeat these ideologies or any group through sheer force. We tried it with Al-Qaeda. Al-Qaeda exists today. And it seems to me that the win for both citizens of Gaza and Israeli citizens is peace. And Hamas has now said that they are willing to put down their arms in favor of a two-state peace deal on the 1967 borders. Now, I understand why some may be hesitant to accept Hamas's word at that, but surely the way forward is to call their bluff and finally work towards achieving peace.
Well, what you're saying makes sense, except that no one believes Hamas, and no one.
But why wouldn't we just call their bluff? Let's call their bluff.
I could not agree more, which is why I said twice, and I'll say a third time. Part of that post-war Gaza governance or framework that Israel has so clearly refrained from presenting has to do with calling the bluff, saying, okay, we're willing to stop this and enter negotiations with the Palestinian Authority, not with Hamas. If Hamas joins the Palestinian Authority, supposedly that's none of Israel's business. It cannot determine its own interlocutors. However, you have to understand something, Ali. October 7th was devastating. It was humiliating. It was agonizing. It shook Israel to the bone. And when you're proposing something which is very sensible in my mind, but not apparently to many Israelis, to call their bluff by way of agreeing to what they're saying or accepting at face value, what they're saying runs contrary to the current Israeli psyche. So yeah, I agree with you. This is what needs.
Yeah,
to
and
be
I guess
done.
I guess even sorry, I'm sorry to interrupt, but even if we take Hamas out of it, I think the frustration, at least from British eyes abroad, and I understand we're very far away, and it's easier to say that from the comfort of London, but it's how do we actually see resolution? Because this isn't the first conflict, and how do we actually see resolution across 1967 borders? And when we've got Mr. Netanyahu and his government saying basically they've got no interest in a peace deal with Palestinians, forget Hamas, Palestinians in general, there's no end to this.
Right. So let's recall George Mitchell, who was the American mediator in the Good Easter Agreement, you know, in the Northern Ireland Catholic. When he said, when he was told that this lasted for decades and that there have been hundreds, if not thousands, of days of negotiations that yielded nothing and produced no agreement, he said the following, and I'm applying this based on your remark to the Israeli-Palestinian situation. He said, all we need is one good day, which is what we need. And, you know, it's not that we haven't tried. It's been tried in July of 2000 at the Camp David summit. It's been tried since then in 2004. Again in 2008. In 2005, I go back a few years, Israel unilaterally withdrew from Gaza and did not get peace in return. So I'm not here to hand out.
I will say in 2005, when Israel unilaterally withdrew from Gaza, we saw a massive increase in settlements in the West Bank in Palestinian areas. So it was a redistribution of occupation rather than a cessation.
Okay, that's one way of looking at it. Another way of looking at it is that the Israeli government in 2006 was planning a unilateral withdrawal from a vast swath of the West Bank. It never happened, so this is academic, what I'm saying and what you're saying. But back to your original question, Ali. That's exactly what needs to be done. But to tell you that this could be done while Hamas is still in Gaza and while Israel has an extremist right-wing coalition with theocratic, nationalist, borderline fascist elements in it, to tell you that anything good is going to come out of this, I can't.
And can I ask you about some of the internal dealings? I believe you're talking to us from Tel Aviv. We've seen protests from Israeli citizens to the way that Israel has managed, or like you say, maybe mismanaged this operation. Give us a brief insight into the current climate in Israel.
Well, there was just a big poll that was published today. Let me read out the main findings. 68% of Israelis think there should be an election held. 74% think that Mr. Netanyahu should resign, divided into 45% who think he should resign immediately and 30% who think he should resign after the war end, whatever that means. 63% of Israelis replied that they think the war is Mr. Netanyahu's fault. So this is, you know, this is the main gist of Israeli public opinion. However, there's a flip side to this. Israelis are not storming the streets and demonstrating. Neither there are demonstrations. There are daily demonstrations, and they should be lauded and appreciated, but you don't see mass demonstrations. And the reason for this has to do with, you know, Israeli political culture, the Israeli psyche of you don't demonstrate in the middle of the war because you have a son, you have a brother, you have a neighbor, you have a father, you have a best friend who's in the army, who's in the military and fighting in Gaza. So you don't go out and demonstrate. So you do see tens of thousands, but you do not yet see hundreds of thousands. Now, from here, we could talk about, I mean, we need another show for this, but I'll try and keep it brief. The political machinations and the political system. Mr. Netanyahu has a coalition of 64 out of 120. So that's slightly over the 60 majority. In order to depose him, to depose of him or him, you need five Knesset members, parliament members, who will defect just for a vote of no confidence. They can't be found because his party and his coalition is a bunch of acolytes and sycophants. So you need to rile the coalition. Riling the coalition can only happen once the portions of the opposition, which joined the war cabinet, withdraw from the government. They have yet to do so. So so the public mood at this point is very much subject to what happens in the political system, and vice versa. The political system will not move without public pressures and protests.
Do you feel that the end of this conflict or the end of this part of the conflict is dependent on Benjamin Netanyahu leaving his position?
No. I think that he is, you know, in history, and I'm not talking about 50 years down the road of historians writing a authoritative history of Israel. I'm talking about the next 2, 3, 4 years. He will be remembered as a what the Economist called him years ago, a serial bungler, an inept, incompetent politician who failed and miserably in almost every sphere or aspect of political life. And so to assume, Zoe, that he has a place, that he has a role to play in the end of the conflict is assuming too much. Now, unless, of course, I've been answering the wrong question and you meant this current conflict, this current war that's going on, in which case he has a role to play, but I don't know that he's going to do it on his own volition.
And I mean, you referred to Netanyahu as a bungler and even implied that he's a failure. He's been called something else here, and that's a war criminal. If the ICC rules that Israel, as it has already, that there's plausible case on war crimes to be answered for, if it rules that Israel has committed war crimes, and Mr. Netanyahu, even to the extent of is issued an arrest warrant, what do you think the reactions in Israel will be?
Yeah, well, look, he's not accused of war crimes. What Israel is being accused at the ICJ, at the International Court of Justice, is for genocide by South Africa, which is the plaintiff.
Is genocide not a war crime?
Well, of course it is, but there's a distinction here. Genocide is a major war crime. There are other war crimes, the use of specific munitions.
Sure, chemical weapons, treatment. Things like that, yeah.
Exactly. So he is not accused of war crimes. Now, if you accuse him of war crimes, then you might as well accuse the entire Israel Defense Forces of war crimes for many years gone back. That's not going to happen. And as for the genocide claim, it's going to be extraordinarily difficult to prove because there needs to be a clear and unequivocal evidence of intent, of intention to commit a genocide, and that's not going to happen. Now, you do, however, raise an important point, Ali, and that is, what if the ICC thinks differently than I do or comes to legal conclusions that I'm not equipped to reach based on the information that I have, and they do issue arrest warrants, including for Mr. Netanyahu? That's going to be a big deal. That will be a big deal, and I know that he's extraordinarily concerned on the verge of being of panicking about this.
I mean, you spoke about how it might be difficult to prove intent, but we have had more than one senior member of Israeli government use what, you know, alleged genocidal language, including Deputy Knesset Speaker Nissim Vitari, who wrote that Israelis had one common goal. He wrote this on Twitter, erasing the Gaza Strip from the face of the earth. We get regular videos on TikTok of Israeli soldiers of what I think you would agree are horrendous videos. We've had journalists talk about Gaza becoming a slaughterhouse in Gaza. There is plenty of evidence of intent.
Ali, I wrote an article about 3 months ago saying that the entire South Africa case could 90% of it could be based and only on remarks by Israeli politicians because they are so stupid and so callous and so irresponsible. And that gentleman that you mentioned, by the way, he's, you know, no disrespect, but he's 70 IQ on a nice day. That does not absolve him from the severity of what he said.
No, it includes people like Ben Gavir as well. And they might be stupid, well, but they have the control of an army against a largely civilian population.
That is true. But the answer to a prime minister. So I don't care about what they say. I mean, it's important what they say, and it is being used against us, against the state of Israel. But the ultimate responsibility and the ultimate accountability rests with the prime minister, not only because he's the prime minister, but also because he, in his recklessness and criminal negligence, appointed them. Mm-hmm. And he knew who he's dealing with. He's not a stupid man. He's a smart and experienced man. He knew the kind of people he's appointing. Not only that, he never called them into order. He never reined them in. And so, yes, it's if you just take the collection of those idiotic statements,
there's a lot of them. There's a lot of them. This is the problem. If I'm honest, Mr. Pinkus, there's a lot of them from very senior people.
I live with these people. I know exactly what you're talking about.
Yeah, and I mean, Netanyahu himself has not been free from that. He has also made numerous comments and imagery that has been problematic. If I may lastly ask you, and I appreciate your time with us today, sure. I always like to ask my guests to look forward a little bit and guess. I know it's difficult given changing variables. Do you think we're going to get an end to this war soon at any time?
No. You want me to expand on the word no?
No, I thought it was quite powerful. For us, I think the world, I'm sure Israelis, and certainly people in Gaza are desperate for an end. Why do you think that an end isn't in sight?
Because I go back a few moments ago when we discussed about Israel's definition of what would constitute a victory, what could be declared as we won. And Israel is not there yet. And if things are frozen right now, then Israel can't claim to neither topple Hamas nor eradicate it militarily. Hamas has been significantly degraded militarily. It has been hurt politically. But the road to end this war is diplomatic. It is not military. That's something that this government is extraordinarily...
And if we're talking... if we're talking about total victory for Israel, how many men, women, and innocent men, women, and children have to die in its wake?
I can't answer that because it's a hypothetical, because it won't happen. There won't be a victory, and I hope that no one gets killed, let alone thousands.
Okay, thank you so much. That was former Israeli policy advisor to two prime ministers and Israeli diplomat Alan Pinkas. I appreciate you joining us from Tel Aviv. We're going to look back on the show. We've had Zach Polansky. We've had, like you have just heard, Alan Pinkas on the show. And I'm joined by Zoe Grunewald. I'm going to get that right, I promise.
It's okay.
We're going to be look back on the show after this.
FUBAR Radio presents...
So we have got the incredible Sunita.
How does Sunita whittle down the people she wants to talk to the people she doesn't? What's your criteria?
Well, you've got to be an adult.
okay.
That's always a good start.
Always a good start. But when I'm an adult, not just like 18, you've got to be like not young enough to be my child. you have to ideally... be London-based, because I am. Yeah. Although I don't mind if you've got a country pad, that would be nice.
So at the minute, we're going with age and location are important.
Age and location are good.
Every Friday from 6 p.m.
FUBAR Radio.
So So Zoe, your reflections on what we've just heard.
I thought it was fascinating. I thought it was deeply sad to listen to. I guess one positive you can take from it is that clearly this shift towards Benjamin Netanyahu's approach to the war, it's turning, and people are really starting to feel that something has to give there because it's just not sustainable.
I was quite surprised actually to the scale of opposition from Tel Aviv as we were hearing. It's been a brilliant show. Zoe, thank you so much for joining us. You have been a superstar, and I know we're going to have you back on for foreseeable shows in the future. So thank you so much. I've been joined by our co-host and political journalist, broadcaster and commentator, the brilliant Zoe Grunewald. We've had Zach Polansky, deputy leader of the Green Party. He joined us to talk about the election results. Israeli diplomat and former foreign policy advisor Alan Pinkas as well. I've been Ali Milani. This has been Politics Uncensored. Salams.